Well, good morning. Goodness, I hope it wasn't something I said. Kind of dropped off this morning, but we're glad you're here. And it is a wonderful thing to see the sunshine, is it not? After the rain. Well, it's been a busy week in my life. I don't know about yours, but I appreciate it. All the Lord has helped us to accomplish, and to accomplish safely. That's always something I include in my prayers. I not only want to be productive, but safely productive. Well, we got started a little bit in chapter 58 of Isaiah last week, but I'll start reading at the top of that again. Today, and I do just want to reflect on one verse from 57, which is a highlight in my mind. I always want to remember where God is coming from. For thus saith the high and lofty one, Isaiah 57, verse 15, the lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. So if you ever take a course in theology, they will talk about this verse expressing the transcendence of God. He is high and lofty. He is holy. So he is above all creation. But it also expresses the immanence of God. He dwells among his creation. That is, he is with and in the contrite and humble ones. So quite a contrast there. And quite a different kind of God than the pagan gods. In verse 1 of chapter 58, we start a new section here. And Isaiah says, cry aloud, spare not. Lift up thy voice like a trumpet and show my people their transgression and the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways, as a nation that did righteousness and forsook not the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinances of justice, and they take delight in approaching to God. Wherefore have we fasted, say they, and thou seest not? Wherefore have we afflicted our soul, and thou takest no knowledge? Behold, in the day of your fast ye find pleasure and exact all your labors. And you remember, may remember last time that a better understanding of that verse is an understanding that shows that he's talking about exacting labor of your helpers, your laborers. So you're supposedly depriving yourself of pursuing all your natural wants and desires, but you are making others procure for you. So what kind of fast is that? It's kind of like in the ages past, there were times whenever the Jews became known for their money lending capacity. Of course, it was unlawful for them to charge interest to one another. The Jews couldn't lend to Jews on interest, but they could lend to Gentiles on interest. And so it became one of the few jobs that they could fill, because in the Middle Ages, Christian Europeans couldn't lend on interest to one another either. So who's going to do it? You got to have that particular function in a productive economy, there has to be a way to gain capital to do business. And so if you're going to outlaw it among those that are close to you, then you select a special group of people to do that. Anyway, interesting how all that works. But God here is decrying the hypocrisy of going through various religious motions in order to manipulate the divine, in order to get God to do what you want. And unfortunately, this is not an uncommon human activity. He criticizes the house of Jacob here. But we can find ourselves in the same spot, perhaps not using their techniques. We don't go to the tabernacle or the temple and sacrifice and make vows the way they did. But sometimes you'll find people that want to use various spiritual, so-called, exercises to manipulate God. Some people think that they can, with prayer, make God do what they want him to do. And that's a totally, totally messed up mind. God would say, is that the kind of prayer I'm looking for from you? The kind of prayer that he honors is the kind of prayer we saw in Jesus Christ, his son. In the Sermon on the Mount, he begins his famous prayer with, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And then he goes very quickly to, Thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. So that's not a perspective which is trying to manipulate God. It's a perspective which brings him into your heart and mind and life and reality and yields the path that you're going to take to his will. His will in earth, in the earthen vessel even that you inhabit as it is in heaven. And then, of course, we see the peak, we sometimes think of it, of the surrender of Christ being expressed in his, once again, a prayer in the garden, where he expresses how he's feeling to God. That's part of our praying. We communicate with God where we're at, what we're expressing. Oh, sorry, what we're feeling. We express what we're feeling. And then we open ourselves up to him and offer our will in subjection to his. And so here we have the opposite going on. We have the Israelites criticized for their partaking in these various religious activities for the purpose of manipulating God, or at least pacifying him so that he won't bother them. So God gives the contrast here. He says, is it such a fast that I have chosen? A day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this a fast and an acceptable day to the Lord? Is not this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke. Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house? When thou seest the naked, that thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh. And so I hear in those verses some other passages that get spoken by Jesus Christ then in the New Testament. If you look at some of the issues there that Isaiah is concerned with, this having a concern for those that are hungry, those that are without clothing, and I often reflect on the whole clothing issue because in some ways it seems so different in our day. Clothes were expensive and important in the ancient world. We live in a weird world where if you tear your clothes up a little bit, they're worth more money, right? Ever see people take perfectly good outfits and rip holes in them and scuff them up and make them look like they're worn? There was a time when it was a shame to wear clothes like that. Now you pay big bucks for it and flaunt it. But so in some ways, we reflect on these verses as like, wow, how things have changed. There's a number of times in life when I think I would like to help these people out with their nakedness, right? I would like to supply them some clothes, but they wouldn't appreciate it much. There was a time when that kind of exposure was a shame. It was not something that you flaunted. So things have changed.
It's still a shame.
Well, that's true, Mr. Dan, but it's not universally recognized that way, unfortunately. But it is still a shame.
It's so sad, and reviewing how the idea that we're just animals, it plays down into so many aspects of life that there's not dignity, there's not self-respect, there's not value to the human body that's sacred.
Yes, and you know part of the force that they are employing to get the kind of reaction that they want is this sort of shock and suspense of how far will they go, right? If you're constantly pushing the limits, that tends to create a bit of edginess about things and people. And, I mean, that's what they want to create. But the problem is, you can only go so far. Then what? You know, you've got nothing but shame. But here, the picture is that of having compassion on those who are naked because they don't have anything to put on. They can't afford the clothes. They don't have the resources. And so the picture of compassion is still something we can apply to our world, whether or not the solution is as simple as that of kindly giving something somebody body doesn't have. It's still a matter of shame, and it's still a matter that we have compassion on their condition of being destitute of life's basic needs. So Isaiah says, if this is the kind of departure, and so it's interesting here that the fasting is pictured as fundamentally not so much that of going without yourself, but of departing from the normal drive of life to procure more for yourself. It's a call to awareness of the needs of others. Isn't it? Isn't that what he's appealing to? And that's kind of a other than you would expect. You know, we usually think of fasting in a very personal way. How does it affect me? We're pretty conscious of that, right? So if I go without food, I know how that feels. And but the call here seems to be that fasting should make us aware of the needs of others. Because look at the different instances that he gives. What kind of fast have I chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, to break every yoke, to deal bread to the hungry, to bring the poor that are cast out to thy house. And when thou seest the naked, that thou cover him, and hide not thyself from thine own flesh, or the needs of thine own kinsmen. So those are all things that cause you to, that involve looking outside of yourself and your own needs. Verse 8, then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go forth. Read that again. And thy righteousness shall go before thee. The glory of the Lord shall be thy re-reward, which is a word we don't normally use, but it means your rear guard. Okay, so there's the picture of what goes before and what comes behind you. And rear guards are important. You don't have eyes in the back of your head. Maybe some of you thought your parents did when you were young. They could tell what you were doing when they weren't looking. But that's just because they had experience. They were kids once themselves. They had a pretty good idea. And they get to where they know you pretty good, too. But it's important to have somebody. It's important that somebody has your back, as we sometimes say now. And here the picture is, thy righteousness shall go before thee, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then thou shalt call, and the Lord shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, here I am. If thou take away from thee, the midst of thee, the yoke, the putting forth of the finger, and speaking vanity, if thou draw out thy soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness shall be as the noonday. And the Lord shall guide thee continually, and satisfy thy soul in drought, and make fat thy bones. And thou shalt be like a watered garden, and like a spring of water, whose waters fail not. Okay, so we often chuckle at some of the ancient images of prosperity. Those fat bones. That's not something that you could, not an image you could sell things on today very well. If you're advertising, you probably don't want to make that the key theme of a 610 commercial, I don't think. But if you think literally, though, of the contrast between somebody who's starved, you see their bones, right? And somebody who is healthy, you make those bones fat, so to speak. It's kind of a funny way to say it in our minds. But if you think about it, you can get the point. A watered garden, a spring of water whose waters fail not. And they that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. If thou turn away thy foot from the Sabbath, from doing thy pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of the Lord, honorable, and shall honor him, not doing thine own ways, nor finding thine own pleasure, nor speaking thine own words. Then shalt thou delight thyself in the Lord, and I will cause thee to ride upon the high places of the earth, and feed thee with the heritage of Jacob thy father, for the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it. So once again, we have an expression here, a clear expression of the heart of the message that we as human beings need to hear and hold. It is not doing our own pleasure. And it's not a matter, what's important though is to gain the understanding that it's not a matter of punishment. It's not a matter of, no, you can't do what you want. You got to stay in your yard. Got to play with your own toys. So on and so forth. This kind of oppressive sense. It's that God knows what is good. And that is probably the hardest lesson in the world for we human beings to learn and to really hold it foremost in our mind. God knows what is good for me in my life. We are so easily deceived by desire. And sometimes we want to categorize desire into compartments. So there are good desires, right, and there are bad desires. And as long as it's a good desire, I'm good, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I can allow my life to be totally possessed by good desires. Well, if that desire happens to be to find God's will and do it, I would agree with that. But the fact is, the desire mechanism in us is faulty. It fixates on things which aren't valuable. And that's not our fault. Can't be condemned for that. The problem is, we don't want to surrender that. Because desire is a precious thing in our mind. It will make us happy, right? If we get it. Always.
I think that is really difficult from a human standpoint, because when the desires fall into what we think is the good category, like, well, why? I mean, it takes everything within you and leaning fully on Christ and his perspective to weed through and figure out what's really going on, because even though it's in the good, what we categorize as good category, could be completely outside of God's will for me. What I think, okay, well, this is obvious, this is what I should do. That may be wrong. It may be just as wrong as like going off over into the bad category. It's a hard thing.
Indeed it is. And for us to learn to embrace the goodness of what God does have for us. I'll give you a personal example. When I was a lot younger, yesterday or so, I enjoyed water and lakes, and I always wanted to build a lake and maybe have an island on it. And I envisioned various possibilities and some of the different properties we owned over the years. And that would be fun to some extent, but I begin to realize at some point, that's probably not going to happen. And I could make it happen. We got some hollers on our property. we can build a lake. But what would I have to give up in order to do that? And then once I got it, something you don't realize when you're young is that little word called maintenance. Anything that you acquire in life, if it's going to remain at all desirable, it has to have maintenance. And a lake can be a lot of maintenance, especially if you want it to look nice and not have undesirables either inhabiting it or growing up around it. And the longer I live, I realize, you know what? Those are beautiful thoughts. I enjoyed thinking about them. But that's just probably something I'm not going to do. I might. But at this point in my life, it's not on the horizon. And I'm totally okay with that. I'll go enjoy somebody else's lake that they're maintaining. And sometimes I drive by houses that have beautifully landscaped yard and a lake and different things, and I think that's nice. But I happen to know that takes a lot of investment, not just in money to do it, but in time to keep it that way. And God has given me an understanding that there are things that are more important, more valuable, and I want to always yield to His determination of what is good for me and keep my time and efforts focused on what He would have me to do.
I recently heard the quote from Brother Heimlich that maybe I'd heard it before, but I don't remember for sure. It was like, wow, that is so true. He said, anything you say yes to is a no to something else. And I thought that is really profound, and I want to keep that in my mind. Because what am I saying no to by what I'm doing right now? You know, there's always something. I just thought that was really helpful.
Yes, that is. I actually thought of that as I was talking about this. Yeah. We're finite creatures, so we can't say yes to everything. And so, of necessity, when you make a commitment on one level, you're turning something else down.
I think another area in thinking about that good, what is good, and there are good things for Laura, you, or someone else that may not be good for you. So that category can look really good, but it may not be good for me. I think that's been there. I think that's a place in life that it's a little bit hard to understand sometimes, but it's true.
Right. So we have a consistent message here in Scripture, whether you're looking at the Old Testament or the New, concerning what it takes to be in a relationship with God that is pleasing to Him and beneficial to you. It's a message that He is good, He knows what's good, and a surrender to His goodness brings light into your life, brings light into the dark places, brings light into the desolate places. And I will cause thee to ride upon the high places of the earth and feed thee with the heritage of Jacob thy father, for the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it. Isaiah 58. At some point, I had made a connection to an earlier passage in Isaiah, again reflecting on this idea of God's goodness and his knowledge of what is good to me. So in Isaiah 40, verse 27, as we read some time back, why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, my judgment is passed over from my God. Okay, so in other words, poor me, God doesn't notice me, I'm barely getting along here. What about me? What about my life? Verse 28 then, he says, hast thou not known, hast thou not heard, that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. He giveth power to the faint, and to them that have no might he increaseth strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Sometimes the hardest job you have in life is that of waiting. Think of hard jobs. Sometimes we say, well, he's got a hard row to hoe. And sometimes it's the work that's hard. But speaking from experience, I think sometimes the hardest job is waiting, not seeing yet where God is leading, not knowing how things are going to turn out, but staying steadfast in your commitment to his goodness and his will. I sometimes get poked fun at a little bit because I don't always have a quick answer to what I'm doing 6 months ahead or sometimes 6 days ahead, occasionally not even 6 hours ahead. But the fact is, I am conscious of the options, usually, and there are factors that aren't in place yet. I don't know. I am waiting. And the poet Rudyard Kipling in his poem If says, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting. And that's, I think, an important component of our overall approach to life. I understand there are times when people have to make plans, and so you have to sometimes make decisions when you're not quite ready. But there is also value in being able to wait until things become clear enough to act properly.
It's fair. The other side of that is when we don't give enough time to think through everything and make a decision and realize, oops, I didn't think of that. So there's wisdom there, I have to admit.
And I confess that part of my personal indulgence in that way of thinking is because a lot of my life depends on the weather. And so who can predict that, right? Even with the modern advent of computers and all sorts of satellite imagery and whatnot, it's pretty difficult to know with certainty very far ahead what's going to happen. I was faced one day this week, Thursday, with the prospect of taking a tree down in another city. And it's not the kind of thing you can do when it's raining. And so the forecast says 24 to 30%. And you have to decide, do I or do I not? Well, I waited to the last minute to, what's the radar say now? And I think we can do it. And fortunately, we got it done. But, I mean, I don't like having that level of uncertainty in life. I would like to be able to say, I'm going to do this, this, and this. But some things depend on the weather. And so that, I say, has given me a good preparation for being willing to wait on God. And I hope I always am faithful with that, because They that wait on the Lord, he says here in Isaiah 40, 31, shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint.
Keep part of the nature of waiting.
Yes.
There are times that we wait and we know that there's a deadline, so we have to wait until something. And so
yes.
Maybe that anticipation, because you know that the waiting is going to be over. You know, whatever, turn 16, you're going to get your driver's license, whatever, you know. But I think a more difficult thing is when it's an open-ended waiting. You're waiting and you don't know. You don't know what the result's going to be. You don't know what you're waiting for. You don't know what you're,
yeah.
How long you're waiting. What am I looking for? What's the next step? I'm just waiting.
Yeah.
Trusting. You know,
and isn't it true that our character can be forged in those times? At least I'm trying to learn this, that when I don't know the outcome, I'm trying to find out, okay, Lord, for this moment, the next 5 minutes, what is the best thing I can do? Try not to think of myself as always waiting, but just what needs to be done right now.
Absolutely. Waiting can be an opportunity, because if God hasn't given you clear direction, then you can say, well, what can I do productive in the meantime? And you can learn things about life and things about productivity that you perhaps otherwise wouldn't if you're just waiting for that big thing to happen. He expects you to give your 100% too, right? I know that, again, reflecting on my own life, there was a lot of emphasis in the church, and has been over the years, of doing God's will. And so as a young person, I was very concerned about choosing a direction, a college that would have been in his will. I felt like probably more education would be helpful to me. And I didn't feel any strong direction from God in any particular way. I didn't feel a strong push to go to a Bible school or any particular direction. I had a lot of natural interest in electronics, science, engineering. And so it got to that point in high school where, okay, so it's time to take the ACT test, time to make application to go somewhere, and God hasn't spoken to me in any discernible way. And so I'm assuming he wants me to make the best decision I'm able to make. Not ever saying, okay, he doesn't care, but based on what I know, based on his word, based on what I understand about life, where should I go from here? Always open to any closed doors that he throws up and trying to be conscious of the open ones. So then I felt I'm going to have to make a choice. But I did make a choice that said, okay, I'm going to go to, well, I'll give you an example. One of the choices that was open to me was the University of Illinois. And they've got a very reputable engineering program. But I had heard from the talk among the kids was that if you go to the U of I, you've got to be a member of a fraternity, because they have files on all the classes and they've got records of all the tests. And if you don't have access to that, you're going to be at a huge disadvantage. And I'm like, I'm not going to get involved in fraternity life. That's not going to happen. So in spite of the fact that it might have been in terms of the ratings of the school, a great place to go, it wasn't even an option in my mind, because I was going to have to subject myself to a force which was absolutely outside of the values that I knew were part of following God and would just put me into an environment in a world that would make it very difficult to make the right choices. So while I felt like I had to make a choice, my choices were shaped by information that I had at my disposal concerning those influences.
I was just thinking also about, we have these, I remember my natural desire, we feel like, you know, maybe sort of like the Israelites, if you do what's right, God will bless you, and, you know, and I'd have images of what that looked like, and so I was thinking I would pursue what I thought was good, but it ended up, Jesus lived a life not pursuing anything like that looked. And if I'm following him, what does that look like for me? You know, I can't, if he puts me in a particular position somehow, and I'm not driving for that, but he just gives me a responsibility, that's one thing. But for me to try to be what I thought was good, it made me think very hard that, okay, if Jesus is the example and I'm to take up my cross, what does that look like? It's not maybe what I thought by just the natural
process. Yeah. You know, Jesus likens the kind of faith that we are to have in him to the faith of a child, right? To trust like a small child. But we don't want to ever forget that the small child is not the perfect image of what we are to be like in everything. Small children have totally irrational desires, and they are totally possessed by them. And they themselves, after they've lived a while, will look back and say, well, that was dumb. You know, that wasn't understood. I didn't know what was going on. And so part of the process of growing up involves coming to grips with the fact that our desires may be unquestioned and unenlightened and uninformed and in need of examination, even though they're precious to us. And so Paul also says, when I became a man, I put away childish things. So while we herald the faith of the little child, or at least elevate it as an exemplary kind of trust that we're to have in God, we recognize that children are not by nature well informed about what is good.
Keith,
yes.
Also, speaking of the whole thing as far as a calling, I think we build up a little bit of mythos around it, that if you, for example, you better not get behind a podium and start and ever preach if you don't have a quote-unquote call to preach.
Uh-huh.
We kind of put that on people. And I've also lived long enough to watch people who thought they were called to a particular thing get totally fixated on that particular calling and ignore doors that were getting slammed shut by God and just completely be unable to pivot and do something else. And so they wind up pretty much wasting their life.
Yeah.
Because they failed at their quote-unquote calling and they don't have enough sense to back up and say, what does God want me to do today? What does God want me to do now? Sure, I thought I knew, you know, God's will back then, but maybe I heard incorrectly, or maybe things have changed in some way. I've watched plenty of people think that they got God's quote-unquote will for their life,
uh-huh,
and then never question it again and actually wreck things up quite nicely.
And I think you bring to light there the delicacy of dealing with young people in that stage of life where they're making those choices. Some people, older folks, in their zeal to fill the pulpits of the land and to build churches and whatever, project their energy on others, and it's very easy, I think, at that stage in your life, you are challenged, you are inspired by the older generation's vision, and it's easy to make it your own when God might not be involved. You want to be absolutely sure that it is God's voice that you hear. And quite frankly, too, we sometimes talk about, you know, we sometimes have holes for people to fill, which aren't necessarily even biblically described. You know, we have a society, we have a world, and you'd think, you know, if you spend it in some areas, that the only way you can be doing God's full-time service is if you're a preacher, an evangelist, a missionary, or a song leader, like on the road kind of song leader. And that's a very narrow vision of God's work in the world. He does a lot more stuff. And the fact that you aren't up front every Sunday does not reduce your importance to the kingdom of God. It does very much increase the level of pressure in your life and the level of responsibility, but it doesn't decrease your importance. And that's an important thing to latch on to. You know, we are his hands and his feet to all the world around us. And God needs his people in every vocation, every legal one. Well, I can't even say that. There's some legal vocations you should stay out of. Please don't feel called to start a marijuana dispensary, even though it's now legal in the state of Illinois. But I think you understand what I'm saying. There are needful services to be performed in all of life that God needs his people involved in.
Keith, if you think of the best way, the quickest way to spread the good news, to impact the world for Christ, mm-hmm. You know, if it was only on the backs of what we were talking about here, quote-unquote, ministers, you know, that's a tall order. But what if every Christian, every mm-hmm. Uh-huh. In their corner of their world, their little sphere of impact, which actually isn't quite little, it's
right.
Quite large.
Mm-hmm.
What if everyone behaved that way and thought of their interaction with the kingdom and with God in those terms and then behaved accordingly? I mean, there's no stopping that.
No. Yes.
It just seems, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, we do need, you know, folks in different capacities and, you know, whatever, and that's fine. But the overarching thinking of how you interact in God's kingdom and what your capabilities are and what you're commanded to do, the opportunities.
And what will really blow your mind, if you'll let it sink in, is to realize that in John 17, when Jesus is praying to the Father, he says that the way that the world will know that he in fact is who he said he was and that he was sent by the Father is by having great preachers do worldwide conventions and crusades. Oh, that's a different version. By their love for one another. That's pretty astounding, really. And yet, if you've had any experience in life, you realize, yeah, that is what transforms how people think about things, relationships. And when they see how the Christians can get along, compared to the relationships in their own life, they're like, there's something different there. Your life is different. I'm drawn to that. I want that. It's as simple as the kid with the ice cream cone, right? And the other kid looks at it and says, that person's happy. I want some of that too. It's on a different level, but it's as natural as that. And when we depreciate the importance of that force in our world, we're kind of ignoring what Jesus taught. Because in that moment, as he prayed to the Father, he could have said anything in the world. It was all at his disposal. And he said that. So, this message is consistent, I say. And once again, Isaiah is pointing us to that kind of relationship with God, which not just makes him Lord, doesn't just make him the boss, but it embraces him as the ultimate good for us. Very good. Thank you for your kind attention.
told thy love to me, but I long to rise in the arms of faith and be closer drawn to thee. Draw me nearer, nearer, blessed Lord, to the cross where thou hast died. Draw me nearer. Precious bleeding side, consecrate me now to thy service, Lord, by the power of grace divine. Let my soul look up with a steadfast hope, and my will be lost in thine. Draw me near. Blessed Lord, to the cross where thou hast died. Draw me nearer, 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 blessed Lord, to thy precious bleeding side. Oh, the pure delight of a single hour that before thy throne spent. When I kneel in prayer and with thee, my God, I commune as friend with friend. Draw me nearer, nearer, blessed Lord, to the cross where thou hast died. Draw me nearer, 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 blessed thy precious bleeding side. There are depths of love that I cannot know till I cross the narrow sea. There are heights of joy that I may not reach till I rest in peace with thee. Draw me near. Blessed Lord, to the cross where thou hast died. Draw me nearer, 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 blessed Lord, to thy precious bleeding.